bifurcation with symmetry. So probably you know what the problem is. Sometimes the eigenvalues meet on the imaginary axis and then they jump off the imaginary axis. And sometimes when you have symmetries, they just pass, seem to pass. And this was a very nice problem to work on. Thank you very much. There was a lot of stuff coming out of this. People involved were also, I should mention, Ian Melbourne from Houston, now he's in England, in Guildford, and Jürgen Scheuerle in Hamburg. And we were able to classify the generic eigenvalue movements. We developed an equivariant normal form theory, Williamson normal form theory, and as a corollary, we proved an equivariant Abou theorem. So this was quite nice, actually. But this is not the end of the talk. About 10 years later, I got a message from Jerry saying, well, why don't you try to use your set-oriented numerical stuff in space mission design? And this is something I would like to talk about today. So this is like a report, of progress report of what we did so far. So what I'm going to talk about is first I'll introduce you to the set-oriented numerical methods for dynamical systems. I'm giving you an overview of what one can do in space mission design. So for instance, I'll briefly touch Genesis. You've seen this before. Martin talked on this. Martin is not here. Oh, there you are. Sorry. Yeah, Martin talked on. Martin, I'm sorry, I didn't want to check whether it was so fine. So Martin is here. He talked on Genesis, and we did some computations on Genesis. This is already 2-3 years ago. Then more recent things are formation flights for spacecraft. There are two missions, namely the Terrestrial Planet Finder, which has been mentioned before, and an European analog, which is called Darwin, and we are working on these two missions also with set-oriented tools, numerical tools. And finally, there's some work which is really ongoing right now, and I put all the names here down here which may be potentially on the paper. So these are people who are involved in the discussions right now, so I don't know what will be on the paper in the end. This is trying to compute transport phenomena in the solar system. We've seen some geometric approach this afternoon, early this afternoon. These methods here, which I'm proposing here, are of statistical nature. They are somehow complementary. I don't say they are better than the geometric approach, but I think both of them are quite nice to use. Yes, the research has been supported by the DFG, DRD, NSF, and also by a company. Lesenhagen is somebody working at Astrium, which is a space company in Germany. They are interested in this formation flight stuff. Okay, so the software we've developed over the last years in general, not just for Hamiltonian systems or space mission design, allows you to compute global attractors of dynamical systems. It allows you to compute invariant manifolds, and in fact this has applications, the invariant manifolds, as you saw before, in space mission design. Moreover, on the statistical side, we can compute invariant measures for dynamical systems, and we can also compute, and this is important for transport, so-called almost invariant sets. Okay, so I will touch all of these points in this talk, just to give you an overview. So the codes have been implemented in the software called GAIO, Global Analysis of Invariant Objects. If you're interested in getting this, you can contact me, and then you will get a copy of it. Okay, so what was the origin? The origin is already in, was in 96, 97, where we found out that it's difficult to compute solutions of dynamical systems. So let me show you some, or let me give you some motivation. Let's just simulate this ordinary differential equation here, Schur circuit with MATLAB. And then it's just one ODE. If you don't know it, it's okay. If you know it, it's also okay. So let's compute the solution. It's a three-dimensional ODE, first order, and here you see a typical solution. So what you can observe, it's very complicated. It's probably chaotic. Let's not think about numerical errors at the moment. And then you can ask yourself, what can I really compute when I look at this? It's maybe not a good idea to try to compute one single trajectory for this dynamical system. It may be a better idea to try to find out how likely it is to observe a typical trajectory in certain areas on this invariant set. For instance, it's quite likely and it's very probable to observe this trajectory in this area here, in this one. It's very unlikely to see it in this area. So the notion which is behind this, you know this, is the notion of an invariant measure. So why don't we try to compute an invariant measure? Moreover, So why don't we develop numerical techniques for computing these invariant measures? And moreover, when you look at this, when you can see it in the bank, when the trajectory enters this part of the invariant set, then it stays there for quite a while, now for instance, and then it goes back into this part. So maybe we can identify not just the statistics in the sense of invariant measures, but also maybe we can find information on higher level somehow by saying, well, if something enters this part of state space, it stays there for quite a while, and then it goes to other parts. And can we quantify this? So this was the goal. Now, let's go back to the transparencies. So the strategy was as follows. First, compute the invariant set, and then, so the set A up here, and then approximate the dynamical behavior on the set. So the approach is not the one that you say, well, let's compute one trajectory for a very, very long time, but let's try to attack the problem of finding the set directly, okay? So this is the idea, and here's how it works. This is now the Lorentz system. We start with a big box in 3D, in this case, and then we cut it into pieces, and we throw away pieces of phase space from which we know that there's certainly nothing of the invariant set we're interested in, okay? So this is how it works. This is the picture you should have in mind when you listen to the more technical stuff, which comes later on. What we do is we start with this. We have a subdivision strategy. We chop this big thing into pieces. We throw away certain parts, and this way we shrink down to the invariant set of interest. In this case, an invariant set for the Lorentz system, right? Okay, this is how it works. One more turnaround, maybe. Okay. Okay, so as you can see already from this video is that, and I really would like to emphasize this, these methods in general, they work very nicely for even for high-dimensional phase space if you would like to find low-dimensional objects. Low means two, three-dimensional objects. They do not work. They do not work if you would like to, it's clear, right? If you would like to find something which is six, seven, eight-dimensional. Okay, this is a problem. Good. Okay, so what do we compute? Little bit of mathematics here. We have a discrete dynamical system, this one here, xj plus 1 equal to f of xj, and for compact set Q, Q is this big box we started with, the big box, the big blue box. We compute this set. This is the forward image of Q for all iterates, under all iterates of f, and then the intersection of this. Okay, in particular, when you have invariant set inside Q, you keep it, right? It's in the intersection. You should view this object as being all the invariant sets plus the unstable manifolds inside Q. This is what you really compute. And here's the algorithm. So it consists of two steps. First, this is the subdivision process. This says nothing else but if you have a collection of boxes, then you construct one which consists of smaller boxes by chopping it into two pieces, each box, for instance, into two pieces. The main thing is that the diameter of these boxes has to shrink. And in the second step, and this is the crucial step, you say, well, I just keep those boxes in this collection of smaller boxes for which there's an pre-image somewhere in another box. This is very easy. I mean, I don't know why, but it's very easy. So you just say, well, I have these 5 million boxes, and I just keep those which have a pre-image somewhere else or inside itself. Okay, that's it. Of course, this has to be discretized and so on, but I'm not talking about the numerical details here. Example, Henon map, you know this, a two-dimensional diffeo here, f of xy equal to 1 minus a. A and b are parameters here, a and b. And here you get an approximation of this relative global attractor for this Henon map. Yeah, you can see there's the Henon attractor, if you've seen this before, most of you probably is somewhere here. On top of this, we get this unstable manifold of an unstable hyperbolic fixed point, which is down here, which accumulates on this attracting invariant set up now. Okay, so this is how it works. We have convergence. This was in 97 with Andreas Hohmann. You can really, for this abstract algorithm, you can compute, you can prove convergence. This has nothing else, but if you do the subdivision stuff, then you shrink down to this set AQ. When you do subdivision after subdivision and so on. yeah, you can also prove something on some results on the speed of convergence, which is pretty obvious, right? If the set is very contractive, then it will converge faster than in the case when it's not so contractive, right? So this is not so difficult. Okay, so here is the example. Now, we looked at discrete dynamical systems. For an ODE, you take a time t map, right? And then you can compute these coverings for this attractor and Schur circuit, right? You get this very quickly with Gaio. This is a matter of a second or so. And you can also do a very fine computation. And let me compare this to the simulation we saw with MATLAB here. For instance, this is now is supposed to be the same object, but we get indeed this part here now. This is covered where you could have never been sure whether a trajectory will meet this part or not. We can compute this. I mean, it's very robust, right? We approximate these sets from the outside and shrink down. It just works. Okay, now let's come to invariant manifolds. So this is global attractors, invariant manifolds. So now, if you take a hyperbolic fixed point, P, and you take a neighborhood N, and you have an unstable manifold WU, yes, unstable manifold of P, then what is this? What is the global attractor relative to this neighborhood? If you think about this subdivision procedure, what will it do? It will, in the stable direction, it will shrink, right? Boxes get eliminated out here, it will shrink, and in the end, you end up with the unstable manifold, local unstable manifold. That's an easy observation. Nothing to prove here. Yeah? I mean, you just end up it's the unstable manifold if the neighborhood is small enough. So, and if you see this, then you can have an idea on how to compute from an outer approximation of invariant manifolds. And this is schematically done here. So you initialize, again, this is the Hinon map with this hyperbolic fixed point up here. You take this neighborhood of this hyperbolic fixed point, and then you do the subdivision step. You get a coarse covering. These are small blue boxes here of the unstable manifold. This is what we saw before. This is now a covering of AN. And then you continue this, right? You just map these boxes out. And then you always keep a covering by construction, right? You have a covering, you match it. You must keep a covering. And then you can do this globalization or continuation if you want. It's not really continuation in the path-following sense, but you globalize this local unstable manifold by mapping the boxes. And you map again and map again until it stops. At some point, you've done it, right? You covered the entire manifold. And of course, you can do this also in a very with very tiny boxes, with small boxes, in order to get a nice covering of this one-dimensional manifold. Okay, so this just works. Again, you can prove convergence on compact subsets and so on. Maybe it's not so interesting, probably. Everybody could do this, probably. It's right? If you converge and you do the subdivision, get smaller and smaller, you get a tighter and tighter covering. That's not so good. Discussion. This is interesting. In principle, I said this before, in principle, you can apply this algorithm to manifolds of arbitrary dimension, right? Can do it for 2 or 3, you shouldn't do it for 10, okay? So, but in principle, you can do it. More important, and this is more important for the space mission thing, is, I came back to this. This is also, as I said before, the dimension of the manifold is okay. But this is more important here, it works for general invariant sets. For general, even if you take a torus or a periodic solution, and you cover the periodic solution and you globalize this way, it will work the same way, right? And this is really an advantage, for instance, to other. I just mentioned a couple of people here who have been working on the computation of invariant manifolds. I should say that, in my opinion, maybe I'm... For one-dimensional systems, there are certainly more... For one-dimensional manifolds, there are certainly more sophisticated techniques to compute these manifolds. However, for high-dimensional invariant manifolds, 2 or 3, this is a very nice and robust way to compute these invariant manifolds. Okay, here is the genesis trajectory. You saw this before. This is the halo orbit here. And what genesis does is it approaches this halo orbit along the stable manifold, and it will leave it in about 1 year's time, right? In another two years, along the unstable manifold. And here you can see a coarse covering. Of course, this is the halo orbit. And here you can see you just apply this technique for computing invariant manifolds. You compute these unstable manifold part of it with these coarse boxes. You can also do it completely. useless, but you can do it this way if you want. I mean, it looks nicer, but the other day I said it's completely useless, and then somebody in the audience said, why is it useless? It's so pretty. Yeah, I said, yeah, okay. But it's for space mission design, it's useless, right? So, or maybe it's not. I don't know. But we can do it. It just shows we can do it. So we can compute the unstable manifold in this way, the two-dimensional one. And I also show you a flight along the unstable manifold here. This is part of the picture you saw before. Here, this is a revolution of around the halo orbit. And then at a certain point, I think it does two revolutions, and then it leaves the halo orbit and flies along this unstable manifold and does then this pass by Earth, and then it can come back to Earth via this heteroclinic connection via the other halo orbit around L2. Okay, so now, let's see. This thing is very unstable, actually, right? Yeah, it's highly unstable. And then you see now you get off the halo orbit and make your way back towards Earth, and you pass Earth, and then you can do the way back along the other orbit. Right, okay, so this is a typical flight along the 2D unstable manifold. So much about genesis. So now these things we've been doing a couple of years ago already, the invariant manifold stuff. This is very recent. This is something we've been working on since fall last year. There are two missions which are now planned, I think, namely the TPF mission from the NASA, Terrestrial Planet Finder, and the mission Darwin by the European Space Agency. And these two missions have essentially the same objective, namely to find Martin didn't mention this morning, so that's why he mentioned this, namely to find Earth-like planets in other solar systems. And the way this should be done is by having a couple of spacecraft, like here, which form sort of, it's not the right technical term, but this is my point of view, which form sort of a telescope. So you have it in a hexagon, for instance, and at the edges of vertices of a hexagon, and then you try to find, with this big telescope in space, you try to find Earth-like planets in other solar systems. And the question now is, from the dynamics point of view, and this is, I think, very interesting. Again, Jerry was suggesting this, to look at this. Right, I just remember this, yeah. It's very interesting to try to find some location in the solar system where the natural dynamics is such a way that this hexagon, these spacecraft, don't get it distorted a lot. Okay? So the best thing would be to throw this hexagon in, and then it stays a hexagon while it does a revolution and looks into the other solar systems. Okay? So how do we find this? And this is the problem we look at. This is, again, the restricted three-body problem here. You've seen this before with these five Lagrange points. So, and we the flow is phi t, and we really try to find now somewhere here, we try to find a good location for our formation flight. Okay, so how do we do this? And the idea was, again, let's do the set-oriented stuff. So the idea was, well, okay, instead of, what did we so far? We had these boxes, and we threw single points, initial points, into these boxes, let them go for a certain time t, and then on the basis of this information, we were able to shrink down to the objects of interest. Now, if you're interested in deformations or stuff, why don't you throw in geometric objects? Right, so what we did is, We just took a tetrahedra, and say we defined a certain, yeah, this is of course, you can discuss this notion, but we said, well, okay, let's take this quantity as being a measure for the deformation of this tetrahedron. Phi t is the flow of the dynamical system, and then we try to find a location by looking at these deformations for the formation flight. I should say that there's another paper by Kuhn, Marston, and Murray, where they are using Poincaré sections and trying to also to minimize deformations. Okay, so what we do is, again, we have these boxes, right? This is now a Hamiltonian system, difficult, no dissipation or so. So it's, you have lots of boxes here, and you try to find boxes in this in phase space for which the deformation is minimized. So in every box, what you do is you throw in these tetrahedra and you compute this average. Okay, and here's a global picture. So what you see here is the deformation. So you, I should say the length of the edges in the tetrahedron is between 150 and 1.0 meters and 1.5 kilometers. And then you get this global picture. So here's the sun, here's Earth somewhere, and then you find very high deformation in this area, low deformation here, low deformation, and so on. You get this target pattern. Okay, so but this is not really useful. So let's zoom in. This is now near Earth. Earth is here, and here are L1 and L2, and you get this picture. You see, this seems to be not bad here. This is quite low deformation here, also in this area, but this was still not too difficult, really, to locate something reasonable. So we went down to a neighborhood of L2, right? This is now L2. Earth is somewhere here, so it's 1.06, so it's somewhere here, right? So here's L2, and here you see what you get is when you compute the deformation for 244 days. So red means that when you start here and you let it go, the tetrahedra go for 244 days, you get a very high deformation. If you start here, it's quite low, right? So, but it doesn't really make sense to look at one specific time, right? I mean, it may be that the tetrahedron gets stretched and then it shrinks again, it's quite nice. So then you're not very happy with when you haven't seen the stretching before. So what you should look at is really a temporal evolution of this. And here's a picture of the deformation from 3 days up to 244 days. So now what you, I will let this go a couple of times. And what you see is the following. It seems that waves come in from the left. Then this deformation builds up here around L2 in this strip. This is the X and Y direction here. So we look in X, Y, Z plane, so it's X, Y direction. But when you look more carefully, you can see that now it's up to 1 year, right? So when you look at this region here, for instance, up here, there's hardly no deformation at some point, right? So here comes a wave in, but it's in principle, it's quite nice. So now from this picture already, you could say, well, maybe I should choose an initial condition for my formation flight somewhere here. Or somewhere here. I certainly shouldn't go in this area here or somewhere down there. Okay? So this is something we could do. So these are the observations. There's no region where deformation always vanishes. Okay, that's fine. It's a nonlinear problem. Even if it's linear, we would have a problem. There are regions, this is this picture. There are regions where the deformation regularly grows and shrinks, and you see this picture, it goes up and then it shrinks again. These are these waves coming in from the left, right? So, this is what we observe. So what we then did is said, okay, let's average this and see what the average deformation is in order to find a good location, and this is what we have here. So we just average all these deformations. And then indeed, you find this is the location we saw before, that it's quite nice up here and also down here. So maybe we can search for trajectories with low deformation in these areas. Okay, and here is one. This is now precisely this one here. We start with it, and now you can see why it has such a... This is precisely what we saw before in the talk, right? It just goes off, right? It goes off, and you can never see it again, but it has low deformation. But it is not really helpful, right? So, but it's low deformation. Yeah, so let's try another one. So this one was also quite nice. So it does something, and then it goes off. Low deformation, but... Not very sufficient, not very nice, right? So another one here. This is, this is not so bad, but here it came too close to Earth. Apparently, this is not a good trajectory. So this was also one which we couldn't use. So in the end, we said, okay. So why don't we restrict to halo orbits around L2? There's a feasibility study by the European Space Agency where they also, and I think you have been mentioning this, where they also suggested to go. To go to a halo orbit around L2, and here's the family of halo orbits which you've seen before around L2, and what we now do is we compute the deformation of these tetrahedra along this family of halo orbits in order to find a nice orbit for our formation flight. And here's the picture. So if you just start with any old initial condition without thinking about it, then initial conditions are important here, right? Then you get this type of deformation along the halo orbits, along the family of halo orbits. But then when you adjust the initial condition according to a certain idea you have, then you find this picture, and this is again the family of halo orbits, and this is with an adapted initial velocity, then you find that there is a dip here, somewhere here. So this, you should view this. This is parametrizing the halo orbits. This is deformation. Here's the deformation. Here's time. So what you would want, if you look at this picture, what you want to pick is this halo orbit. And indeed, you can pick this halo orbit, and then you can show that the deformation is really much lower, even lower than the one in the feasibility study by the European Space Agency. And on top of it, we can also solve the control problem, but I don't want to go into this right now. So when you have, now we found the halo orbit, and then the question is, how do you do station keeping there? And this problem can also be solved. In fact, you can show that the additional energy you need in order to do the control of the configuration of the six spacecraft along this halo orbit is negligible in comparison to the station keeping of one spacecraft in this halo orbit anyway. So this is very nice for us, but Astrium wasn't very happy with this because they wanted to build new thrusters and stuff, but this is not necessary. No, that's fine, yeah. They said, well, are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. Yeah, and we were able, with the set-oriented approach, we were able to find this location, a nice location, which is much better than the ESA orbit, halo orbit. Okay, so now the last 15 minutes maybe, or 20 minutes, I would like to address the problem of transport in the solar system. And here let's go back to where we started from. We have this invariant set, and now let's suppose we can compute the box covering. We've done this, like for the Lorentz system or like for the Chua circuit. And then based on this box covering, you can associate with the dynamics a Markov chain. So this is not so difficult. I mean, here's the box covering. These are D boxes. D is 5 million, for instance. And then we compute this transition matrix PD. D is the same as this one, which has the following entries. PKL is the transition probability with respect to Lebesgue measure from box BL into box BK. So it's like a matrix with transition probabilities from one box to the other. In the numerics, the numerical treatment, the construction or the computation of this matrix is the major numerical effort. Right? Anything else is really nothing in comparison to this. So you compute what you should have in mind, I will come back to this, is that you really approximate your continuous dynamical system, your deterministic dynamical system, with a Markov chain. This is all you do. And then you can, And then F is the dynamical system, the one we started with. Xj plus 1 equal to F of Xj. Okay, it's the time T map for your ODE, if you want, yes. So what you do is really you approximate your dynamics with this Markov chain. Okay. Yes?
You're doing this only in configuration space?
No, let's go away from Hamiltonian systems. Okay. This is the general dynamical system, any old dynamical system right now. So let's get away from Hamiltonians right now. Okay? That's right. Yes. This is right. These are boxes and I should say that when you emphasize this with n-dimensional boxes and n-dimensional phase space, I should say that there are very nice ways to store these boxes. You don't store centers and radii of these boxes in this program, but what you do is you just to store a binary tree. So whenever you search for a box, you just search the tree. So the memory requirements are not really the problem. The bottleneck is the computation of this matrix. Okay. But it's something like you have a dynamical system, there's noise in it anyway, right? You can talk about this. So why not approximate it on a coarse level with this Markov chain? I know geometers won't like this, but it's one way to do it. I mean, you can do it. And here's the invariant measure, which you can compute. Oh, now you have the Markov chain. You compute the stationary density of this Markov chain, and then you get an invariant measure for your dynamical system. Now you say, well, convergence, and so you can prove convergence in certain cases. You can prove if you have a hyperbolic attractor with an SRB measure, this thing will really converge. Okay, so we don't know whether this is hyperbolic, we don't know whether this has an SRB measure, but we still do the computations, and this is the picture here. You get this invariant measure, and you see it's very likely to observe trajectories in this area. Yellow means very high probability. Here also, this is again the Yechua circuit from the very beginning, very low probability in this area here with blue, and blue means very low probability. So this is precisely what we thought should come out, is that you observe trajectories with a high probability in these two areas here. I should say that if you know Chua circuits, there are some unstable steady state solutions here. That's why you have these peaks in the invariant measure. Here's another one for the Lorentz system. Yeah, just to show you that it works. There are some, what you can observe, for instance, again, yellow means very high probability, blue is very low probability. What you can see, for instance, here's a yellow band corresponding to an unstable periodic orbit, which is vaguely unstable, and so you get this picture here, very high density around the unstable periodic orbit. Okay, now, so this is stationary distributions, this is invariant measures. Now you can say, well, if I have an invariant measure, this corresponds for my matrix, if you think about the matrix, corresponds to the eigenvalue 1 of my stochastic matrix. Now, intuitively, this was nothing else but intuition, you can say, well, if I have an eigenvalue which is close to 1, this should correspond to something which is almost invariant. Hand waving at the moment, right? So, but if you have an invariant measure, eigenvalue 1, stationary distribution, if you have an eigenvalue which is close to 1, 0.95 or whatever, it should be almost invariant. And let's consider the simplest situation where you really can make this precise analytically, not numerically. And this is a joint paper with Gary Freund and Stefan Serpel, which appeared 2 years ago, and on one-dimensional maps. So I'm far away from Hamiltonian now. Let's look about one-dimensional maps. So we have this map, we look at this map on the interval from 0,1 into 0,1. And what we really wanted to analyze there is to see what happens if you have, if you have an eigenvalue which is not 1 but close to 1. And what we did for this map is the following. We started with a map 2x mod 1 here, 2x mod 1, and another map 2x mod 1 here in the upper block. So if you look at this map on the entire interval, you have a double eigenvalue 1. One eigenvalue corresponding to Lebesgue measure here, another eigenvalue 1 corresponding to Lebesgue measure here. So you have a double eigenvalue 1. Now when you pull this branch down and this one up, like now, if you do this, then the two intervals, they start to communicate, right? And one of the eigenvalues will go inside the unit circle. So what's happening in this case? Let's look at the situation here. So here, there is on the other end, this is the result by Vivian Baladi, when these branches are onto here, then one can show, I cannot go into the details here, but then you can show that there is no isolated eigenvalue which is really relevant for the dynamics. So what we did is we picked the map in between. So for instance, this map here, here you see there is still a gap here, so the two sides now communicate, but there's a gap. These branches are not onto, and you can prove for this map that it has an eigenvalue 1. It's not so difficult, but it also has another eigenvalue which is not 1, and you can also show that this operator, all the eigenvalues in the continuous case, you can what you really should look at is a continuous transfer operator. It's like a continuous version of the Markov chain. All the other eigenvalues or the other part of the spectrum is bounded in here. So in particular, the essential spectrum is bounded away from this second eigenvalue. Okay, so now if this eigenvalue has something to do with almost invariance, you see in the beginning these two parts were invariant. They were invariant, and then they start to communicate and you get almost invariant stuff. Then you should see this in the eigenfunction. Here's the invariant measure on the left-hand side, so it's the density for the invariant measure. And here on the right-hand side, what you see is apparently this eigenfunction for the second largest eigenvalue is positive on 0, 1 half, and negative on 1 half 1. Okay, mathematician, right? You say conjecture here, the assigned structure of this eigenfunction has something to do with the almost invariant parts. Probably, right? And this is something you can indeed make precise. So, in other words, what I'd like to tell you here is the following. You have the invariant measure, the invariant density, and you have the second largest eigenvalue, corresponding eigenfunction, and apparently the sign structure here picks up almost invariance. So, and then in a paper with Oliver Junge, we proved the following result. If we call a set A, this is now again our dynamical system, A, delta almost invariant with respect to some measure sigma, yes? So this means that the ratio of pre-images of a set A with respect to the measure of A, inside A with respect to the measure of A is delta, this is this, and lambda is a real eigenvalue of this matrix, if you want, or of the continuous operator, which is not one, so it's here's the eigenvalue problem, then you can show that this equality holds, that this delta, a measure theoretic quantity, is nothing else but the eigenvalue plus 1 divided by 2. So this means, for instance, three cases, let's see whether it's correct, whether it's consistent. If lambda is equal to 1, you have 1 plus 1 divided by 2 is 1, so the set is invariant. If lambda is equal to minus 1, if you know Markov chains, you know minus 1 corresponds to a 2-cycle, right? One part is met into, there are some nice results on this what is your first name? Message. Igor message right now on this. So if you have a 2-cycle, when you have an eigenvalue minus 1, you have a 2-cycle in your Markov chain, and then indeed, when everything from here gets mapped into here, then delta is 0, right? Everything leaks out. And the other case is lambda equal to 0 is something like 50-50. One never knows, right? So if you go out, in or out. So this is something you can prove. In other words, you can now what you can do is the following. You compute your transition matrix. You have your box covering, compute the transition matrix. That's expensive. Then you compute the eigenvalues. This is not so difficult, in particular if you're interested in the five largest ones. The second largest one gives you this number here, and then you have a quantitative result about the almost invariance of your subset you're looking at. Look at the sign structure, right? Yeah, okay. That's almost invariance. So for instance, in this case here, you can compute this data using the eigenvalue and you get this amount of almost invariance. Now we are brave, of course. Now when we understand 1D maps, we can do ODEs, right? So here's the Chua circuit. And again, what you see here is now nothing else but the computation I told you before. You compute the second largest eigenvalue, have your box covering, transition matrix, second largest eigenvalue, sign structure, color it this way, and then you get this picture. And here's a typical simulation, and you see these two parts, yellow and orange, they are almost invariant, and you can see when you start there, you stay in there, and then at some point, you leave it again, you go over to the green part. So these parts are almost invariant. Okay. Solar system. So now, we said, well, why not apply this now to transport phenomena in the solar system? Let's try to find out how likely it is for some object in the Kuiper belt to get into the inner solar system. So by the first idea was, and we've gone beyond this now, is to concatenate circular restricted free body problems. So at first, let's consider Neptune, Uranus, like you did for the invariant manifolds, right? Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, Jupiter, Jupiter, Mars, and so on. And then compute the transition probabilities from the outside region of this planet, of Neptune, say, to the inside region, so to go via Neptune towards Uranus. Okay, this was the first idea, and indeed you get some results. Oh, here's a spectrum for Jupiter, for instance. Oh, you can hardly see this, but this is, again, the same you saw for the transition matrix before. This is a typical spectrum. Here's 1, and when you zoom in, you can see that for a certain time t-map, you find a second eigenvalue at 0.994, for instance, for this value of the time t map. So this is the Jupiter spectrum, so three body problem, Sun, Jupiter, asteroid. And here's the picture. You've seen the Hills region before. This is for different energy levels here, right? So this is for relative low energy. You get, you can see the red area, which is an almost invariant part. Here is Jupiter, and then you get this bottleneck here, and here's the blue area. And with these computations I've shown you before, you can now make really quantify the probability to go from the outside region via the interior region into the inner region, just purely statistical arguments. Yeah. Or, yes? This is configuration space. Yes, this is something, this is precisely, yes. This is, these computations are very expensive, in fact. I'm going to the four-body problem in a minute, and that's even more expensive. For the four-body problem, these computations took days. It's something like what we do is for all these millions of boxes, and for all the boxes, you choose hundreds of initial conditions, so you have billions of trajectories altogether which you look at. But in principle, you have even more, because via this Markov chain approach, you have all the different ones, right? You just not just have the, but you have all of them. No, these compute. I don't want to make this, but make it simpler than it is. But it's just, I just want to show you that you can do it in principle. I mean, it's, yeah, but in principle you can do it. It's a lot of work, but in this sense it's straightforward, right? You have a Markov chain approach. You compute the transition matrix. You look at the spectral information. You use this result on the eigenvalues, and then you can compute these figures. But the numerical effort is significant. Yes. So here, for instance, when we take a Jacobian constant of c equal to 3.004, we fix this for all the three body problems. Then you can compute with this delta. You can compute these numbers for the probability to pass these planets. And then you can multiply them and get some answer. But I'm not brave enough to do this, but by assuming that these events are independent, right? Which is not the case. But if they are independent, then you can just multiply them, and then you get some number which tells you how likely it is to get an object from outside Neptune into the inner solar system. I cannot resist. I would like to mention this here. What I'm very interested in particular with the molecular dynamics stuff we are doing right now is the following. Yes, I have time. When we have a Markov chain, I'm certainly not the first one who has a Markov chain. I mean, Markov chains are around for a long time, and in particular, people in computer science have been looking at Markov chains. And I should say that also this problem of dividing phase space into different parts, which are almost invariant in our sense, in our dynamical system sense, has a parallel problem in computer science. Namely, when you have a certain cluster of processes, when you do parallel computations, you have a cluster of processes, and you would like to have a nice load balancing and not a lot of communication between the different clusters, then you would like to find a cut in this graph, in this Markov chain, so that the information which has to be transferred from one part to the other is minimum. Same problem as here. Precisely the same problem, right? We would like to identify parts which are almost invariant. The same problem. So what we started last year, in fact, is to Robert Price is and we've written a couple of papers on this now. Robert Price is from computer science. We now adapt graph theoretic algorithms which are known for this cluster problem to dynamical systems and combine them with the multi-level structure and to get even more even better algorithms and clearer cuts. You see, the sign structure is not very nice because sometimes you have a number which is 10 to the minus 6 and you don't know whether it's positive or negative. With these graph algorithms, you get a clear cut. For instance, here's a picture for Jupiter again, and you can compute this here. There's just red and green and yellow here because it's now an optimization problem. You cut it into three pieces. And this is now a graph partitioning, and you get the interior region here yellow, and you can compute precisely how likely it is now to get from green into yellow and from yellow into red and so on. And this is using graph theory, alternative approach. Now finally, let's go to the four-body problem from Mars and Jupiter. And this is something which I found really fascinating, which is again parallel to what you found with the manifolds, is the following. We now look at Mars, Jupiter. This is just a very coarse, coarse covering of phase space. It's the four-body problem, Mars, Jupiter, Sun, and asteroid. And then if we do a finer covering, you see it just showing you that it seems to converge, that you get nice results. More boxes, even more boxes. And then what you get is, for the invariant measure, is you get this picture. So here's the Jupiter orbit, here's Mars, and what you find is this very nice high-density region here, which is precisely at the asteroid belt. Right? And yes, here it is. So here's the oh, you cannot see this. Here's the asteroid belt. If you look at the you cannot see this. This is the location of the asteroid belt. So here's another four-body problem: Saturn, Uranus, and you get a completely different picture. Here's the Uranus orbit. Here's Saturn, and you don't get any asteroid belt here, right? It just you get a completely different invariant measure, just to make sure that the asteroid belt is not shouldn't be an asteroid belt between Saturn and Uranus, right? So, okay. So, and here is the again the another picture for Jupiter and Saturn, and here you get the invariant measure. So it's everything will go inside here, and here you, if you look quite close, you can see the asteroid belt in here. And here in this picture, you see the transport problem, and the transport gives you essentially the same result. It says this part, this red part, is almost invariant, and the blue part is almost invariant. This invariant measure result tells you that in this model, everything, eventually, this is a transient part here, everything will move in at some point. This is the transport result. And finally, I have this picture, which I really like. It's another eigenfunction for the Jupiter-Saturn problem. You can see here's the Saturn orbit, here's Jupiter, and here's the asteroid belt. And when you look at this, this is nothing. Let me say this, just emphasize this again. This is admittedly a week of computation time here. Then we have this transition matrix. We compute the spectra of this matrix. We look at the eigenfunctions, and one eigenfunction, the third one, I think, looks like this. And it says, well, remember, red was almost invariant, blue is almost invariant, and you are dead on here. This is the Saturn orbit. Here precisely here's a dip, even more pronounced here at Jupiter. You stay for a long time outside Jupiter. Then you move inside Jupiter, you stay here. Then you have a very high probability here around the asteroid belt, and eventually you can get into the Mars and Earth region. Okay, so my time is up. Thank you very much for your attention.